Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a novelist plumb his own imagination and experiences to create stories and characters that remain in readers' minds long after they've closed the book? Author John Irving has written a dozen novels in his career, including the National Book Award-winning The World According to Garp. He also has an Academy Award for the screenplay adaptation of The Cider House Rules. His latest book, now out in trade paperback, is called Last Night in Twisted River. The novel follows a crippled logging camp cook, Dominic Bacigalupo, and his 12-year-old son, Danny, on the run for more than 50 years following a fatal mistake made by the boy on the night the novel begins. Young Danny grows up to be a writer himself, with a resume that strikingly resembles John Irving's own. So the heartbreaks, twists, and surprises in this darkly comic story are interwoven with an ongoing exploration of the writing process itself and the mistaken assumptions on the part of many readers about the relationship between the author's real life and the products of his imagination. John Irving is with us for the hour to talk about it. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
I have to say, when I read the novel several months ago, before I knew that I would be talking to you, it occurred to me that it would be intimidating to speak about this novel, given that your protagonist, Danny Angel, is astonished at the difficulty people seem to have, and in particular journalists, in understanding that a character can share some attributes with a real person without not being an entirely, in other words, can share those attributes and still be entirely the product of the writer's imagination. Can you talk about that, if you can understand my sort of garbled question?
Well, I think it's understandable that most people whose lives really revolve around the real world, and that's true for most journalists, that's true for most people who aren't in the business of making up stories, it's understandable that they would look at the autobiographical elements in a novel and conclude that they're somehow the most important or the most central. It's exasperating to almost every writer I know, every fiction writer I know, that this happened. What may be more puzzling is that it didn't always happen. I published my first novel in the 1960s, and I don't remember questions of an autobiographical nature until at least the late 80s or early 90s. No one asked you. No one said, is this autobiographical? Is this character based on anyone in your family or someone you closely knew? Is this character you? It's a relatively recent thing. The consuming interest in the autobiographical relationship between characters in a novel and the novelist himself or herself or who that writer intimately in some way knew. It's unthinkable, you know, to imagine that we might interview Shakespeare and begin by saying, well, as far as we know, you're not a member of any royal family, yet that seems to be consumingly all you write about. How come? Or that we would suggest to Sophocles sometime between 400 and 500 B.C., okay, you know, one play about incest, fine, but three plays about incest? What was it about your family anyway? we don't examine those writers to whom we can no longer talk. The presumption of autobiographical material. We assume it came from somewhere else. But some time ago, not very long ago, by my count, not more than 10, 15 years ago, we became fixated on that element. In the case of Last Night in Twisted River, I was being deliberately mischievous. I mean, I basically said, okay, here's a guy, I'm not only going to give him my biography as a writer, that is, I'm not only going to have Danny Bacigalupo go to all the schools I went to at the precise time I went there and make him exactly as old as I am and give him teachers I had or close facsimiles to. But I'm even going to give him my process as a writer, such as it is, the way in which I construct a novel. I'll give that to him, too. And we'll see what people make of that. At the same time, I just as deliberately gave Daniel Bacigalupo a life I've never had, a personal life that is as nightmarish and miserable as I could imagine, a family life of almost nonstop peril. Everyone he's afraid of losing, he will lose. Everyone he loves either dies or leaves him. I gave him the opposite of what a lucky, fortunate existence I've had. But the focus has remained on how much his superficial biography, schools, date of birth, that kind of thing. You know, it's almost always among the first question I'm asked. Foolishly, I guess I thought, you know, I could make it kind of obvious. I could write this novel that is a fugitive horror. This father and his son are running for more than 50 years, and I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that I think from early on in the novel the reader realizes that they're not going to make it. You don't write a chase story that goes on for as long as this one and not have it turn out. In other words, if two guys are running away, of course they're going to be caught.
Yeah, when Dominic prays, give me time, that sort of lets you know what you're in for.
And that's quite early in the story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're right. I mean, that's the key moment when I think you recognize, okay, that's what this is about. It's not that they won't be caught. Of course they'll be caught. It's how long do they have and who's going to make the mistake that's going to lead this awful man right to them. That may be a surprise. That may be unexpected. But certainly you do anticipate, I think you do in any chase story, in any revenge story, that, well, what kind of a story would it be if the guy who's after you doesn't catch up? But all of those things, of course, never happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that this novel, is, in a way, is a funny little capsule of very specific autobiographical information of a very mechanical and educational kind, but all of the psychological motivation that makes Daniel Bacigalupo become a writer because he wishes his own life had turned out differently, all of those things are just completely invented, completely imagined.
Well, I wonder if it's partly a factor of the zeitgeist by which we are really obsessed with memoirs these days. And we, you know, a story that is sold as fiction won't be picked up by a publisher, but one that is purported to be a true story gets a lot of attention. We've somehow lost our ability to sort of be unabashedly interested in fiction.
Well, when you say we, do you mean...
I suppose I mean the American readers or American media, maybe?
Yeah, I have only a slightly different perspective on that. I think you're absolutely right. If what you're describing is American culture and American publishing and the American media, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very lucky that more than three quarters of my income is from translations into other languages, and I am translated in somewhere between 37 and 41 languages at any given moment in time, and I travel a lot. I see what the book or the author represents to cultures of many different countries. And what you say about the memoir and the fascination with it is very true of American culture right now. And American culture has never been very supportive of the book or the author compared to almost any country in Europe, even compared to Canada, which is, if you compare it in terms of its interest in the culture of the book or its interest in the author, Canada is much more like a small European country, like one of the Scandinavian countries or the Netherlands, than it is like this country. If you look at the bestseller lists in European countries, there are many more literary books on that bestseller list than there are on a comparable bestseller list in the United States. I can't tell you why that is, but I can tell you that it is. And it's been that way since the late 70s when I first saw my books translated into other languages. I think most writers my age and older in this country would also say that there was a time when the novelist or the novel was more important, even in how marginalized the world of books is in this country. There was a time when it was more important. I can remember even a time when writers were welcome on more mainstream television programs and you had more time to talk about the book you'd written. Now it's rare. If you want a so-called cultural program on main time, prime time television, well, go to France, go to Germany. It's not going to happen here. So maybe that's just a part of it. I mean, I think whenever the economy takes a hit in this country, what are the first programs in the schools that go? The arts programs. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. The arts programs. It's peripheral. It's tangential to anything anyone needs. It's universal. But that's not necessarily true in another culture or in another country. So, you know, I think I completely agree with what you're saying. I think it's sad. I wouldn't go so far as to say I wouldn't say something sweeping to the effect that, oh, Americans don't read novels anymore. They've completely lost touch with their imagination, and nobody goes to the theater anymore. Nobody goes to good theater anymore. Nonfiction has always been more popular on this country's hardcover bestseller list than fiction. One small statistic hasn't changed from when I started publishing in the 60s to now, which is that fewer than 1% of the adult population of the United States buys hardcover fiction.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. John Irving is my guest. He's a novelist whose newest book is called Last Night in Twisted River. It is available now in trade paperback. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist John Irving. His most recent book is called Last Night in Twisted River. It's available now in trade paperback. You can join us at 800-933-5372. I want to talk about the character of Ketchum, who is this very rough around the edges logger and also happens to be Dominic Machigalupo's loyal but unlikely best friend. He's fascinating to me because he has almost no education, but he is very intelligent. And interestingly, if there is an adult influence in young Danny's life who is a storyteller and is a novelist who will never sort of realize that ability, it's not Danny's father, it's Ketchum.
Yeah, that's true. I've never had a novel that was for so long in the back of my mind before I began it as this one, almost 20 years or more. And as much as I knew about the story, the father-son relationship, the fact that these two guys would become fugitives and they'd be running for 50 or more years and the child would grow up and become a writer. I knew all that for 20 or more years. I also knew about this third man who was a secondary father, but a prime influence. I think he's the most important character in the novel, really, although he's not on stage all the time to the degree that the cook and his son are. He's a huge influence on the story, and the small detail that he doesn't, for the longest time, know how to read is really one of the reasons the story happens at all. Mm-hmm. If he had known how to read, there wouldn't have been a chase. The guy who's looking for them would never have found them. So he's deeply connected to this story. I think he's one of those characters that, rather than based, as they say, on anyone I knew, is more an amalgam of 100 people I knew partially. I think there are a lot of people like Ketchum in rural America. There always have been. Independent-minded people who, at any era of our civilization, always believe that the people who are in charge are doing a bad job, from government on down. Everyone who runs everything is an idiot. And the way things used to be done was always better. We all know people like this. They're funny. They're cantankerous. They can be dangerous. They're not terribly well informed, but at the same time, there's a kind of brilliance to their independence of thinking. People listen to them. They're a little frightening. I love Ketchum as a character. I'm not so sure I'd like to live in a country that Ketchum ran. he is a radical libertarian. Somebody asked me not long ago what Ketchum would be up to politically if he were alive today. Would he be a Tea Party person? A friend of mine asked me. And I said, yeah, well, you don't know. I mean, he could be a Tea Party person, or he could be someone in a tree shooting Tea Party people. He is that unpredictable. He's a loner. He doesn't like anybody, although he has latched on to this cook and his son. And we don't learn until much later in the story the complicated reasons for his devotion to them both. But he's a dangerous and difficult guy. I think increasingly there are people in our country, especially in rural parts of our country, who feel that no one in the country or in charge of anything is speaking for or represents them anymore. It was deliberate in my case to choose even a profession for for Ketchum. He's a river driver. That would be taken away from him. That means of getting logs from the woods to the mill has been, it's come to an end. It was even coming to an end when I was a teenager growing up in New Hampshire. It stopped in the 60s in most of Vermont and New Hampshire. The last log drive down a river in Maine was 1976. So that even the guy's way of life has been altered to the degree that what he was trained to do, what he did best, has been taken away from him. And his anger isn't always well-informed, but it's well-expressed.
I have to say, I smiled when I read in the book that Kurt Vonnegut, as Danny, is professor at the University of Iowa. His chief complaint is that Danny uses too many semicolons. And then I laughed out loud later when Ketchum, who has finally learned to read, complains about the same thing.
Yeah, Vonnegut never liked semicolons. I had an editor early years at Random House. He's dead now, a man named Joe Fox, who over time was Truman Capote's editor. He was Philip Roth's editor. He's famous for having been the guy who turned down Joe Heller's Catch-22. Later, they were good friends. He was quite a famous guy in New York publishing, died at his desk with his feet on his desk, surrounded by so many newspapers that no one could see he had died. Quite a wonderful character who told me once in his office in New York that my fondness for the 19th century had extended to the punctuation of the 19th century, which is true, and that I overloved these things. He wouldn't even say semicolons. He said these things. And I said, "You mean the semicolons?" And he said, "John, to most people, it looks like a small fly that has been killed above a comma." So I had him in mind as well as Kurt's disfavor for the semicolon. But Vonnegut himself used them. I used to write him after I'd read his books and say things like there is a semicolon. I found a semicolon on page 265. There was always one or two, not more.
You've been very candid about the fact that a lot of your work explores the things you fear the most in life, loss of people you care about. Do you feel like when you're writing about those things, when you're sitting down, do you feel like suddenly those hours give you some control over those fears?
Well, I think the idea of having control over fears that are of the nature of an obsession, of the nature of those things that when you wake up at 4 in the morning, it's where your mind goes, it's what you think about. The idea of having control over those things is not very realistic. I'm a very manipulative storyteller, and I like to feel that I have a great deal of control over the novels I write. I know the plot before I begin. I make all kinds of roadmaps or outlines. The main things that happen in my novels have been part of the design for years before I write those scenes themselves. So there are very few accidents in my novels. But that said, you're not in control of the things that obsess you the way nightmares can. You're not in control of the fear of something happening to your children or the loss of losing someone you love or imagining what the effect of such a loss would have on you. I just go there. I don't like it. I don't seek to go there, but in that time when I am making a rudimentary plan of a novel I am going to write, all of a sudden these ghosts, these dark clouds appear, and I say, oh, I see, it's that again. It's this thing coming. There's always somebody missing from the family unit. There's always something that a child has not been told about his own history or the history of someone central to his or her family. There is a secret that shouldn't be a secret. There's something's been kept from someone that should not have been kept from them. There are those things. Melville said years ago to in an essay sort of for addressing what young writers should do, he said something along the lines of, woe to him who seeks to please rather than appall. I think instinctively, I always go there. When I'm thinking about, do I want to write this novel next or do I want to write that novel next, I always come to a point in it that I don't want to write. I always come in thinking about it to something that makes me think, I don't want to do that. I don't even want to imagine that. But if there isn't that, I never write the book. In other words, there has to be something that really frightens me, that really turns me away, that makes me want not to write about it. Because if there isn't that element, I wonder how I could possibly hope to have that kind of emotional, visceral, psychological effect on a reader, on an audience, if something at the core of what I'm writing doesn't fill me with dread and disgust. If I don't feel, oh no, not this. If there isn't part of me that feels that, I think, well, come on, how worthwhile is it then?
You know, like anyone else who's read several of your novels, I've noticed particular themes and obsessions and even objects that crop up over and over. Somebody did online like a little chart that says this novel and these things come up. But what is striking to me is that it never, ever feels like the same story. It's like a kaleidoscope that keeps getting twisted into endless combinations. And it occurs to me that most of us have these obsessions. We're just not called upon to use our imagination and make those combinations. They just sort of stay in the same track all the time.
Yes, and I also think, you know, it's psychologically healthy to not think about those things that obsess you or overly disturb you, and yet I think that's what many writers have to do. It's not enough to do it once. You know, this is my 12th book, and the subject of a child growing up without a mother or a father, the subject of losing a child, the subject of being afraid of losing someone who you will lose. It's believe me, it's not repeated by choice. It isn't in the category of a choice. No more than those things you think about when you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning are a choice. They choose you. You didn't pick them. They have chosen you. They insert themselves and assert themselves, and I think there's a lot of writing that is that way. The character who in this novel literally drops from the sky, the skydiver who is called
Lady Sky.
Truly, I don't know where she comes from. I never knew anyone like this, but she's a character who has, if not always on a parachute, dropped in to at least four or five of my novels. She's Emma in Until I Find You. She's Melanie in The Cider House Rules. She's Hester in A Prayer for Owen Meany. Always this kind of frightening, menacing, aggressive, especially sexually aggressive character who, when you first meet her, seems like a kind of threat to the younger, less mature, less sure of himself male character, but turns out, in fact, to be a kind of guardian angel, even if she's unaware of it. I don't know who that character is, but she keeps appearing. I didn't know anyone like that, but by virtue of the fact that I can't sort of keep her away, she's a character who over time changes very little.
Do you think a character like that could be part of you, not a biographical element, but is there an element of that somewhere deep within your personality that maybe doesn't express itself other than in the novels?
Well, I think maybe it is, rather than those places where you went to school, the kind of things that are documented autobiographical things, maybe the things that you keep inventing, the things that aren't true, maybe those things are in some psychological way also, or more seriously, autobiographical. I must have wished I had known a character like this. There must be some compelling reason why I can't leave her alone, why she keeps coming back with another name and in a completely different circumstance, but her role, her function in the story, her physicality even, is very much the same. I don't know. I mean, I think that's a good guess of yours, sure.
Novelist John Irving is my guest. We are talking about his newest novel, Last Night in Twisted River. It's out now in trade paperback. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this fall. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist John Irving. His latest book, now out in trade paperback, is called Last Night in Twisted River. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Another thing, John, that I kept thinking about after I finished reading the novel was the fact that both Danny and Dominic change names on multiple occasions throughout the course of the story. And they don't, I mean, they change sort of their public identities, but they don't really change who they are inside. But you come to this idea that names mean both everything and nothing.
Well, I think there's a surface reason for the change of names. They're being hunted. Mm-hmm. They're being pursued. They're trying to evade this guy who's after them. So there's a justification for it, and the only one who really objects to it is Danny, who wants to be a writer and who wants to write under his given name. His given name means a lot to him. And so for him to take a pen name, a nom de plume, is upsetting to him. I never really thought personally much about names. I was born with one name. I was named after my father, whom I never saw. For 6 years, I was John Wallace Blunt, Jr. And when my mom remarried and I was legally adopted and my name was changed to my stepfather's name, I was very happy about it because I loved my stepfather. I still do love my stepfather, and I didn't much like being named for this sort of mystery figure whom no one in my family would talk about, the disappearing father person. So I was much happier to have the name Irving than the name Blunt. And there was only a moment when I was publishing my first novel when I thought, oh, well, maybe since I'm putting my name on a book, it should be my actual name. Unlike Danny, I didn't want it. I didn't feel, I had no personal investment in the name John Wallace Blunt. In fact, I was happy to be rid of it. But there was a moment when my first book was bought and someone was going to publish it, that I spoke to Kurt Vonnegut about it, and I said, what should I do? John Irving isn't really my first name. And he just laughed about it, and he said, oh, for God's sake, it doesn't matter what your name is. Don't be silly. And I hadn't thought about it until that moment. That is, I thought it was silly, too. And I've not thought about it since. But I think many people are very tormented by their names or wish that they had other names. And writers can be very funny about their names. And so I was trying to make Danny such a vulnerable soul. Personally, it's not a subject that would have much affected me, or didn't. Because of circumstances, because of how much I love that moment of my stepfather coming into my life. He was the opposite of the evil stepparent. I thought it was a great kick to have a change in name.
So a new name was a gift and not a sacrifice for you?
In my case, yeah. But I know many people who agonize over theirs. And I suppose I was thinking of that in Danny's case. The cook doesn't so much mind, there are moments when he misses the old life he had, but it's less attached to the name than Danny is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Novelist John Irving is my guest. Let's speak on the phone to Mickey in Addison. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. I've been wanting to ask this question for years and years. In The World According to Garp, which I had loved, The World According to Bensonhaver, were you influenced by Flannery O'Connor's short story, A Good Man is Hard to Find?
No. I may have been influenced by Flannery O'Connor in other ways, but a good man is hard to find. No, not especially. I think the period of time when I felt most influenced by Flannery O'Connor was in the writing of my first couple of novels. But Garp was the fourth one, and I think by the time I got to that one, I was not of the influence. I certainly liked her work, but I'm a New Englander, and I think that the influence that Hawthorne and Melville had on me as a kid growing up in New England was of the kind that Flannery O'Connor had on certainly Southern writers. I certainly liked Flannery O'Connor more than I liked Faulkner. She had a much stronger influence on me than Faulkner ever had. But there's something a little bit gothic, not only in The World According to Garp, but in many of my novels. And I think the gothic element there's more of Hawthorne and Dickens and Hardy in my gothic influences than there is of the American South and Flannery O'Connor. I think the 19th century was, that was the century that intimidated me and made me want to imitate it most of all.
You're in your 60s now, is that correct?
So I'm 68, yes.
Okay. How does the passage of time affect the way you understand your characters and their experiences? And I'm wondering if you feel like writers are better able to call up the in-the-moment mindset of, say, a boy or a young father or an elderly person or someone else, better able than the average person who is really sort of locked into what's happening right now and maybe has some memories of what happened before.
Well, I've said before that being a father, as young as I was still a college student when my first son was born. And being a father to a boy still living at home, as old as I am, my youngest son goes off to college in the fall. So, you know, to have a child as old as 45 and one as young as 18, what that really means is that from the age of 22 until the age of 68 now, one or more of my children has always been living in my house. And I think that's given me a very strong connection to children at every age, seeing the world through their eyes. And the passage of time, less than it has affected me, but just as a subject, I think it's a pretty integral part of the 12 novels. Certainly, it's a pretty important feature, as important as any major minor character in 10 of those 12 novels. It's a very important feature. How time changes some people, how some people stay the same. That's fascinating to me. Some people are just, they never change. There's a kind of willful obduracy that just won't quit. And other people are very changeable. And I like those differences. I see the passage of time or the effects of the passage of time as pretty important to most of my novels, certainly to Twisted River.
This is the longest span of time that you've ever dealt with, is that right?
Well, one disadvantage of being as old as I am is that I would trust you to remember that better than I do. So, I don't know. It may be, yes, it may be, although Dr. Larch in the Cider House Rules remembers moments of his adolescence, if not his childhood, and Larch is arguably older than
Dominic at the
Danny
end.
At the end of this novel, or Dominic when we meet him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a toss-up there, maybe. Certainly the focus of this novel, more than 50 years, it's as long as any of my novels, and the focus in The Cider House Rules was only 15 years, even if there is a flashback to Dr. Larch as a young man. It's a very small moment, and it's not in the scope of what the novel is really centered on.
In this novel, there are some really detailed descriptions of food and of cooking, and restaurant cooking in particular, or cooking for these groups of people. Was that something you had to spend a lot of time researching in order to get the details right, or do you have a sort of an interest, an ongoing interest in food?
In many of my novels, the obstacle of how much research there is delayed the writing of the novel itself by as much as 18 months or 2 years. Certainly that's the case with Until I Find You, all those church organs around Northern Europe, mm-hmm. all those tattoo parlors in the Baltic and North Sea ports. There's a lot of stuff to learn, a lot of stuff that was unfamiliar to me. Certainly in the case of the two Doctor novels, A Son of the Circus, Dr. Darawalla is an orthopedic surgeon, and in the Cider House Rules, both Homer Wells and Dr. Larch are trained OBGYNs. So that was hard for me. I don't have a scientific background. I don't have a good medical mind. The research for those novels was demanding. This one was pretty easy. I do have a background in cooking. I've worked in a lot of restaurants. I have friends who are in the restaurant business. They made themselves and their restaurants very available to me so that I was able to remind myself of the kind of controlled chaos that a working kitchen has. But all through college and graduate school, working in restaurants was sort of my part-time job. My best friend when I was a teenager, his mother was a fantastic cook. I learned to cook from her. So I knew how to make a pizza dough and cook some rudimentary things when I was a teenager. My two grown sons, each of them with two kids of their own, they're the cooks in their family, as I am in mine. So the cooking was, it was pretty instantaneous. What I didn't know, I mean, I have a friend who's a great Chinese chef, a French chef, an Italian chef. I know those guys. So I was able to spend some time in their working kitchens and more importantly, show them a draft of an early draft of the manuscript and say, hey, have I made any mistakes? Am I poisoning somebody instead of giving them a good meal? The logging was also very available to me because I have a cousin who's still in the business, and he was very accessible to me. And so this novel was not difficult at the research end because both the logging in northern New England and all the cooking stuff sort of falls into an area of my background.
So no one who read those early drafts to sort of check it out, no one complained about the semicolons?
No, I mean, that's a...
I'm just teasing
a complaint
you guys.
That comes from the past. You know, I think if you read a lot of older fiction, 19th century fiction, or
John, I'm so sorry to cut you off here, but we are completely out of time.
That's fine. That's okay.
The latest book by John Irving is Last Night in Twisted River. It's out in bookstores now. I really appreciate you spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.